I've done a lot of podcasts with AJ Hayfleet, and I have to say that this is his most poignant and well-played answer to any of my initial questions, which are often just statements anyways. I start this podcast off trying to convince AJ that my theory of the Avalanche having a poor pipeline at goaltender could have us in a bad way, and that the Avalanche may not be in a very good situation come the next few years.
Yeah. I mean, they're not.
So to give you a little bit more backstory on what I'm trying to accomplish here, I believe that the Avalanche have a situation in goal right now, one where we don't really have a true starter beyond Varlamov. And with Varlamov's play, it's fair to say that we don't really have an elite goaltender who's going to save a lot of games for us. So as the young core comes up and starts to play better, are we going to have a goaltender who can match that play and help us get where we want to be? And with that in mind, here's a deep dive on the Avalanche goaltending situation.
Is that a known issue that they're willing to not address right now, do you think? Or is it one where they'd love to address it, but they have bigger fish to fry?
You know, it's tough because right now it's kind of after last year, it was like, well, you know, Picks had the terrible year and then they lost him in the expansion draft and they kind of just shrugged that off and they brought in Bernier, who's kind of a known no commodity. And then they've got Varley, and it was like, well, Varley had the big surgery and, you know, how's he going to bounce back? He's got 2 years left on his contract. He has a year after this one. So really, goaltending is really just kind of on the back burner for them right now. It's not something that they're spending a lot of time worried about. They're not focusing on it too much. They're not pouring resources into it. It's just kind of a different approach, given who's running their front office. It's actually kind of a strange approach that they're so blasé about the goaltending position at all levels of the organization right now, because they're just not spending all the time with it. You know, they have a split starter position in the AHL with, the AHL teams as the split affiliation with St. Louis this year. And so each team has like a young starter that it needs to be playing as often as possible. And neither team is getting what it wants out of that arrangement, but neither team is also watching their guy sit all the time. So it's kind of just a weird situation organizationally for the Avs as they transition away from San Antonio and into the Eagles next season. I think we'll see them invest in some more goaltending next year. And they might make a decision on one of their unsigned prospects if they want to. They don't have to make decisions on those guys for a while. But if they want to, and they want to get like a guy like Adam Warner over to North America, then bring him over and see what you have. And hopefully it goes well. But you know, right now it's probably the thinnest position that they have prospect wise. They really only have one legitimate prospect and two flyers out on Werner and Peter Kvacha. So it's just right now not a priority for them. They're using this year as kind of a let's see what we have and then we'll go from there. Given the extra draft picks that they have in the next two drafts, I would fully expect them to commit at least one, maybe two of those picks to going a little bit higher on a goaltender than they have in the last couple of years. They've really attached themselves to overage Europeans that they don't have to make immediate decisions on because goaltenders have such long development tracks. If you get a goaltender that's 18, 19 years old and he's a starter over in Europe, then you know, that's a pretty sweet deal because you don't have to sign him to an ELC and bring him to North America for 3 or 4 years. You know, if you get a CHL kid, you have 2 seasons, you have 2 years that you get to leave him in juniors and then you have to bring him into pro hockey. You're talking about bringing a 20-year-old kid in there. Whereas if you have you go the European route or the NCAA route, if you'd prefer, you've got 3 or 4 years depending on how old he is at the time. But you have 3 to 4 years to make that decision. You're talking about bringing somebody that's 21, 22 into pro hockey and, you know, potentially contributing to your NHL team by 24, 25. You don't get immediate returns on goaltending investments. That's the biggest thing. And that's one of the big concerns with, where the Avs have kind of set themselves up goaltending wise is that it is such a long development track that you get say the Avs draft a goaltender with the pick that they got from Nashville this year, right? So they pick 57th overall, they draft a goaltender in June of 2018. They're not expecting that guy to really be a realistic NHL contributor until probably 2024, maybe, for the NHL team. You expect he'll be in the AHL long before then, but you want to see who those guys are. You want to give them as many reps in an AHL net as possible. You know, ideally you have him be the backup and then you move him up after a year or two of that, and then have him be a starter and then do that for a year, and then he becomes your NHL backup. So, I mean, you're looking at 4 to 6 years that you're waiting on these guys. And right now Spencer Martin is the closest. Adam Werner hasn't been very good in Sweden, and Peter Kvacha, while he's had a great year, he's been tearing up the Czech 2 league, which is like a Czech junior league. He should be tearing that league up, is what I'm saying. It's not the top tier league in the Czech Republic. So you don't want to get too excited about that guy, because the quality of competition is just not very high.
So I feel like I'm not totally wrong then to be wondering what the hell with our pipeline. But what it makes me question, though, is then does this mean that the Avs kind of they have a thing, they know a thing, like a scenario where they understand what's going on here, but they really feel like they can make a trade for a good enough goalie, or that they can draft and bring somebody on quick enough? Because I didn't really know when you were talking about how long it takes them, the sort of life cycle of a goalie. It seems like it's a long, long trip to get a goalie actually NHL ready and consistent NHL.
It really is. It's a long, I mean, you're not going to get very many guys like, we're seeing it in Pittsburgh right now, you know, with Matt Murray, who was, I believe, a third round pick. And yeah, he was a third round pick in 2012. This is 2017, and this is his first like full year of starting for them in the NHL. And that's after he had a brilliant finish to his OHL career, and he was flat out dominant in the AHL. Like, he got put on the quickest development track you will see for a goaltender these days. Like, realistically, you will see, you know, the Marc-Andre Fleury 18-year-old make the NHL team right out the gate after being drafted first overall. Those days are done. Teams aren't doing that anymore. You're seeing, you know, Matt Murray is the best example I have of a guy that he's 23 years old. He turns 24 in May, and he's already got sort of two seasons under his belt. You know, he's got a couple of postseason runs, which really is where he's really cut his teeth more so than the regular season, which is why he was technically a rookie still this year, despite all the games that he's already played in the NHL. It's interesting to see, and we're seeing him struggle a great deal as he crushes my fantasy team. We're seeing him come back to earth, you know, like we're seeing how difficult it is for these young guys to be high caliber starters. It's one thing to go from being dominant in the AHL and then you're a backup and you're effective, you know, and then you're the long-term starter. You're the number one guy. And right now, his numbers are the same as Varley's.
It seems like it's perception, too, because you remember Gerard when he came on in two games in Sweden, right? This really weird setup, but the kid was rocking it. And now he's come back to earth a little bit, but our expectations are so high. We've anchored ourselves in the very best that he can be right now at 19. And everything from there is a letdown. And I'm wondering if that's not the same with goalies, too. Or if this other assumption I have that there's not as many good goaltenders because of the new rules of the game and the speed and the skill of the game that, you know, what we think is a good goaltender, we have to temper that expectation.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to be really hard to find a great goaltender. But one of the reasons why the goaltender trade market isn't very good is because there's so many goalies out there. There are so many goalies that are available every year in free agency, in trade. Everybody's got an excess goalie just kind of hanging around in their organization. You know, even the Avalanche right now, they've got Andrew Hammond just sort of existing in the organization that they would love to trade and get something for. You know, there's just, you don't see a lot of like big money long-term contracts for goaltenders. You know, Carey Price signed an insane deal this last year with Montreal. Sergei Bobrovsky will have to sign one with Columbus pretty soon. But that's why you're seeing, like, when Devan Dubnyk got to free agency, he signed a deal, a long-term deal that paid him like $4 million. You know, the value of the number one goaltender is as low as it's ever been in the NHL, because there's just so many decent goaltenders. And there's prevailing wisdom is in the NHL right now is that the better your team in front of you, the more money you can save at the position. If we look at what St. Louis has done for a number of years, they've been saving money on goaltenders Brian Elliott and Jake Allen. They haven't spent more than $5 or $6 million on goaltending in a really long time. And, you know, a lot of teams have a $6 million goaltender. You know, the Avs are paying $5.9 million for Varley, because when he was having his great season in which he signed that extension, that's what teams were doing. The goaltender landscape has changed since then, and the Avalanche are still sitting with Varley on that contract extension he signed several years ago when Patty Waugh was around. And so they haven't had to deal with the changing of the guard. They haven't had to deal with any of that. They're still paying Varley and they're still doing their thing. They've got him through next year. And it is, you know, it is what it is for him. It's just okay. Like, this is fine. And, you know, with Bernier, they paid prime money for a backup goaltender, and they're not getting their return on it right now. But your guys like Bernier and Andre Pavlik and Michael Hutchinson and Steve Mason, Brian Elliott, these caliber of goaltenders, Mike Smith, these guys are available every year. They're out there for the taking. If you just want to go and get one, you want to give up a decent draft pick, say a second rounder, or a third rounder. Really, it's not like the Avalanche giving up a second rounder for Reto Berra. We're talking about starting goaltending. So the Avs have just kind of let that position pass them by a little bit organizationally. And they've been okay with it up to this point because they don't mind the situation with Varley, and the backup is just sort of, he's just sort of there right now. I mean, he's a guy, you know, I think they play him too much, but, you know, Varley hasn't done anything that says he needs to play 4 out of every 5 games at the same time. And the organization is just kind of spinning its wheels at the goaltender spot right now. And it's just sort of, it's really the ultimate like wait and see situation for the Avs right now, because they're just hanging out, honestly.
Do you think that if the Avs were presented with a trade deal that was at all fair, they would take it for Varley right now?
Probably not. I mean, it depends on what they were getting in return. Like, if somebody was going to give them a first round pick, yeah, take it. Those are insane currency these days. But nobody's going to do that because, you know, why would they? And, you know, we saw Arizona try and upgrade that position last year. They've been looking for a goaltender, and the situation with Mike Smith kind of devolved personality wise, relationship wise, to the point where they got what they could for him. And then they wanted to find a young starter. And so they went out and they gave up the 7th overall pick to go get Antti Raanta and Derek Stepan. You know, they also got for them what would be their first or second line center and a starting goaltender for 7th overall. So pretty good value there in terms of selling the draft pick, but he's a totally unproven goaltender, and they're reaping, you know, they're dealing with the consequences of that decision as he's gotten rocked this year. And that's kind of, I think they're comfortable with Varley just because they know what he is. He's a known quantity, good and bad. And that's, you know, there's value in that, you know, like Antti Raanta has turned his season around and he's been very good for Arizona lately, but you don't really know, you know, it's his first starting real starting role that he's been given. after backing up Henrik Lundqvist for the Rangers for years. And you don't really know who he is as a starter. And, you know, slow start, he's rebounded nicely, but who is he really? Are you going to have to put up with long down stretches, or are you going to get league average goaltending out of the guy consistently? So it's, you know, there's, and with the Avalanche, they know Varley, and there's value in understanding, you know, it's the known quantity kind of creates value in itself versus the kind of this, what I like to call the shiny object syndrome of, you know, you see the Avalanche went out and got Andrew Hammond, and then everybody was, why don't the Avs just play Andrew Hammond just to see what he can do? You know, disregarding that he's not a good goaltender.
I was on that bandwagon, but I'm just a fan that way. And I'm always interested to see how you disagree with me on these things too, because a lot of times you bring logic that I'm just not thinking of. But yeah, I'm that guy too, man. I mean, why don't we just drink the whole bottle of tequila and see what happens? So,
well, at this point, I'm down for giving Andrew Hammond a shot because Bernier's played his way out of it. But the, you know, when they first got him, it was just like, well, we have him. Let's try and make use of him. Let's play him. But I mean, now I'm totally down. Like, let's, yeah, sure. Let's just, why not? What do you have to lose? I mean, come on.
That's, what does he have to lose, right? I mean, I don't see him with a lot of upside. So maybe he's a guy who walks in with just a clear head and he's not too psycho like goalies can often be about things. And just, you know, I mean, Dubnyk was a reclamation project, wasn't he, when he got to the Wild?
Oh, he was a big reclamation project. Arizona had given up on him.
How do you engineer something like that? Are there guys out there that people are looking at going, he might be, we might be able to turn this guy back around?
Dubnyk was an interesting case always, because he was a mid first round pick by the Oilers, and he was their goaltender during all those years where they were racking up first overalls. He was the guy. And so, you know, he played behind some truly, truly terrible teams. And he kind of took the fall for it a little bit there in Edmonton. And everybody kind of was like, hey, there were a lot of underlying statistics that said Devan Dubnyk was better than the waiver wire fodder that teams were treating him like. And him bouncing back the way that he did was not a surprise to me. I thought that there was sufficient evidence that said this is a decent goaltender. You know, I don't, that like 940 or whatever he put up after he first got to Minnesota wasn't something he was ever going to do again. And I don't believe he has. Yeah, he hasn't even come close. So, and he's at a 916 this year, which is right where I think of him as. He's a league average goaltender who on any given night can win you games, but he's not so good that you can lean on him for long stretches and say, hey, carry us to greatness. Are there other Devan Dubnyks out there right now? I'd have to take a look at the league, but I really, off the top of my head, I don't see one. I don't have anybody in mind really where I'm like, ah, the Avs are really missing an opportunity here. I thought Bernier was the best backup they could go out and find, just given the body of work across his career. But he's proving that he needs a much stronger team in front of him in order to find some consistency and be solid. And so that's disappointing. But, you know, I mean, as far as what they need to do for their backup right now, I don't have a great answer. I mean, I'm down for giving Hammond a go, but it's not like he's doing anything in the AHL. His numbers aren't any better than Spencer Martin's, honestly. And the idea that he's some sort of an answer. I mean, he's 29 years old and he's barely scraping by at the AHL level. I just don't, you know.
It does make you wonder, though, then if it's not really an NHL reclamation project, is there the equivalent of a Kerfoot out there as a goalie coming out of the collegiate scene then?
Sometimes you get a couple of goalies that come out every year. Last year, it was the kid out of Notre Dame. Oh my gosh, it was Cal Peterson. He signed with Los Angeles. He'd had a really good college career, and he was kind of the best bet, and he's been very, very good for Ontario in the AHL. A couple years ago, it was John Gillies came out and signed with Calgary. So There was another one that ended up in Philadelphia. I can't remember his name. The Avs were in on him. They really liked him. And they were one of his finalists, one of his like three finalists that he interviewed with and had meetings with and did the whole college free agent song and dance with. But he ended up in Philly, and I don't know why his name escapes me right now, but you do see those guys every year. Those guys come out of college where they either were drafted and it's just their senior year, so they might as well just keep going, or they weren't drafted and they slipped through the cracks and they had a really good college career, and you know, who knows? So there is always the possibility they go that route if they can convince a guy to sign with them. I guess that's always kind of been the college free agency bugaboo, is getting the guys to say yes. You know, you need to be able to build a rapport with the player. You need to be able to sell your vision, and you need to have playing time available. There needs to be a pathway for that player to make it in your organization. A guy is not going to come, like Will Butcher in Denver made no sense because he's going to get dropped into a competition with seven other young defensemen that he's going to be fighting for spots with, and they're not going to guarantee him a damn thing. You know, he goes to New Jersey where they had nothing on that blue line up there, and they could easily guarantee him a spot. You know, you just have to find that sweet spot with an organization, with a player. And that's hard to do. You know, there's 30 other organizations out there trying to sell their vision on, you know, and their and playing time and what they have to offer to these kids. And it's really hard to get them to agree to be in your organization. You know, Kerfoot and Toninato was a coup. We hadn't seen the Avs land a college free agent forever, and they got two in the same summer. And I think both of those guys are going to be on the NHL roster long term.
I'm a little surprised by Kerfoot. I expected him to drop off, but I don't think his drop off is bad. I think it's normal and average. And if you adjust his time accordingly, so be it.
That dude is for real. I did not see that one coming.
His vision's great, man. I mean, the vision, his ability to put a pass across the zone. I mean, Mac tries it all the time. We're totally getting digressed away from goalies. But yeah, I agree, man. I think he's legit, and we got him for a while.
Yeah, I mean, they have him on a 2-year ELC, and then they have his RFA rights for, I believe, 3 years. So they've got lots of Kerfoot's prime.
I love a story like that, too. He seems like a totally hardworking dude, even though I know he comes from money. But, I mean, he's here because he's earned it, and I dig that storyline.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and you look at his career and you look at the good players that have come out of Harvard in the last couple of years, you know, 2 years ago, Jimmy Vesey was the college free agent, and teams were falling all over themselves to sign Jimmy Vesey. Jimmy Vesey's been a very mediocre NHL player, and guess who his center was at Harvard? It was Kerfoot, and Kerfoot looks like the real NHL player there, not Vesey.
So on the goalies, what is the life cycle of a goalie? Is Barley at his peak right now? Is he the best he's ever going to be? Or has he already started to fade a little bit because of age? Where do you see that right now in today's NHL?
It's tough, man. I would say, what would be, Barley's 29 right now. I would say Barley's probably got, I don't know, reasonably one more contract in him before you really start to expect some fall off, you know.
Probably not a sunset contract, right? Something a little more realistic.
Yeah, I mean, 32, 30, 33, 34 years old, I think is, I mean, that's a good life for a goalie, you know. I think that's, his next contract should be 3 or 4 years, like max, like absolute top shelf. There should be no like five to 8 year contract extension. There's no, under no circumstances should that exist. Realistically, the Avs should stop at 2.
And that's maybe different than you'd look at somebody else. Like we were pretty sure about McKinnon, and we got him at what I think is a great deal for a pretty long time.
Oh, that deal is insane.
But you don't do that with anybody over 25, right?
You can. Like there are some, you know, depending on the player, like, he's not, you know, not obviously not an Av anymore, but like what Matt Duchene's going to be going through next year, you know, he is 26 today. He'll be 20. We'll see. He turns 27 in January, I believe, is when his birthday is. And so he'll be 28 when he hits the free agent market. That's an interesting guy. He's right in that sweet spot where you're like, oh no, what do I do? You know, do I pay this guy for 7 years? Do I pay this guy for 4 years? And then he gets another contract after that, you know, that's even more expensive if he continues to produce. So you don't, you know, it's a tough, that's tough sledding. Like that's an interesting spot. You know, with Varley, I believe he's going to be 30 at the time that he hits the market.
And his worth will have a lot to do with how he does between now and then too, right? Is he truly healthy, basically?
Well, he will be 30 in April at the end of this season. So by the time he would be set to hit the open market, he'd be 31 years old. I would not give him anything more than a 3-year deal. And
I mean, he has a history of injury. I mean, you can't really overlook that, even though I think maybe he's healthy enough.
I think he's good now. But I mean, his play health wise, I think he's fine. But his play hasn't been good enough that you want to give this guy like real money. You know, last year he was an 898 goaltender. The year before that, he was only a 914 goaltender. And right now he's a 906 goaltender. That's 914 being the best of those numbers is still below league average for a starting goaltender. And so you're looking at the last 3 years worth of data, despite small sample sizes playing into that, you know, the 927 and the 921 that he put up those couple of years, the first 2 years of WA, those are a long time ago, man. Like you're not looking at that anymore. Those look like career. Oh my gosh. Excuse me. That snuck up on me. Those are looking like the big outliers. He's got 916s. He's got 909, 913. You know, he had a 924 early in his career, a 927 and a 921 in Colorado were his high water marks. And then, you know, he's had a bunch of middling numbers since then. Like he's more often than not, he's just been a below average goaltender. It sucks because you watch him and you see how dominant he can be sometimes. And when he's locked in, how special he is, but it just doesn't happen often enough, man. The switch just does not get flipped often enough. And the bad games that he has are 5, 6, 7 goal games. They're not 4 goals on, you know, 28 shots. That's not a bad game for Varley. That's okay. That's a whatever night for him. But his bad games are 7-0 in Vegas. You know, like it's, That stuff crushes. I mean, they're not even competitive in that game, you know?
And yeah, he's still the fans guy, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone about this perception of Varley being elite, but I've really started to question if he really is. I think he's just a good goaltender.
He's just not. I mean, he's nowhere even in the conversation of elite at this point. It's just that we get seduced by, you know, 57 saves against Carolina. We see that and we think that's Varley. And then we see all the other games and we're like, well, he's not quite himself. Because he's not playing at his absolute best. Almost no guy is going to play at his absolute best every single night. You can't continue to judge players by their peak. You have to judge them by what's in the middle, you know, the guy they are every day. Because any guy, Landeskog had a 5-point period and a half last night. But, you know, that doesn't erase that the 4 games immediately before that, he'd been really mediocre. But if you look at the stats, he was a point per game over those 5 games. You can't be obsessed with the peak. It's important. How good a guy can be is important. You need a guy that can be great. I mean, truly great. But you also need a guy that you can rely on consistently to at least be very good, you know, or even just good when it comes to goaltending, because we say it all the time, but goalies are voodoo.
They really are.
So if you can just get good out of him on any given night, and then you get the 9, you know, then you get a 57 save performance every so often out of him, fine. Like, that's amazing. It's great to have a guy that can give you that kind of game. But this is the NHL, man. Most of those guys are capable of giving you that kind of game. I'll never forget Reto Berra's 41 save shutout of the Winnipeg Jets at the end of the season a couple years ago that cost the Avs a chance to draft Zach Werenski. Like, they ended up with Rantanen. It's all good and well. Beto Berra had a 41 save shutout of a team that needed to win that game to get into the playoffs.
So you think looking at the goalie for his average versus his very bottom is the way to go? Like, if we saw the worst he can be and went, okay, that sucks, but it's not the worst of the worst, and he seems to have a bigger upside on average, that's kind of a reasonable take?
Well, you want to dig into the game logs, and you want to dig into some of the advanced statistics that are starting to come out where, you know, right now, if you were to look at that, what's holding back Avs goaltending, and you just look at save percentage alone and only raw save percentage, you're going to say, well, their save percentage is bad. Goaltending is bad. End of story. But you need to dig deeper into the goaltending numbers and say, what are they struggling with? Is their save percentage bad at 5v5? Is their save percentage bad at 4v5? Is it, you know, are they giving up more shorthanded goals than they should be? You know, like where are the struggles coming from? And then where are the areas? And then once you kind of look at by strength, then you want to look at high danger chances. You know, are they worse than normal that high danger chances right now? Last time I looked, Colorado was the 10th best team in the NHL at limiting high danger chances, and they were 31st in the NHL in high danger save percentage. So they're doing a better job than 21 teams out there at preventing the most dangerous scoring chances in the game, but they're doing the worst job at stopping the ones that are allowed. Is that on the defense or is that on goaltending? You know, and so it's hard when you break into the numbers and you start to go deeper into these things and you say, okay, this is all the data that I have available to me, and we don't have nearly enough. And that's one of the hard parts about player evaluation in hockey, is that we don't have nearly enough data. This is not like baseball where we are swimming in information. We just don't have nearly enough for how the game is played for this sport. We don't have anywhere near enough. And with goaltending, that's especially true because there's so much that goes into producing shots and preventing shots that to just look at a goaltender's raw save percentage and say he's good or he's bad, I mean, it's a good way to get an idea of who a guy is. But how many goals do you think is the difference between a 921 save percentage and a 914 save percentage across the season? You're talking maybe 5 goals, maybe 5 to 10 goals, depending on how many games played that guy has. And so, you know, while there's a big difference between a 921 and a 914 over a long period, you know, like a 5 season worth of information in one season, you're talking about a handful of goals that could have gone either way. You know, remember last year when the Flames came into town and they scored 3 goals off of Avs defensemen and 1 goal off the back wall that they shot off the back wall, and, you know, it bounced off the boards and it bounced on top of Pickard's back and into the net. You're talking about that could be those four goals that they gave up that night. 1 off the back wall and 3 off of Avs defenseman skates are the difference between a 914 and a 919 save percentage, where you have a totally different perception of a goaltender. So, you know, raw save percentage is a good way to start. It's where you should start, but you need to get deeper into that to really dig into, hey, what's really causing the issue here? Where are guys really struggling? Or, you know, like when Varley had his 927 in 2013-14 and finished, what, 2nd in Vezina voting that year, he had arguably the greatest goaltending season of all time at 4v5 on the penalty kill. He had something like a 950 save percentage on the penalty kill that year, which is absolutely unheard of. Like, most goaltenders hover around like 900 because it's 4v5. They have an extra guy on the ice. Like, your save percentage is not going to be very good in those situations. You're going to give up a lot of power play goals across the season. You know, like, it shouldn't be very good, but that's what was driving Varley that year. His save percentage was only 927, despite his 4v5 being what any to anybody who had recorded any of the data, it was the greatest goaltending season that any guy had ever had on the penalty kill for all the seasons that they recorded that data. It was insane, man. Like, it was crazy. And, you know, and it wasn't something that could be repeated. So when people talk about that great year that he had, that's what was driving that percentage, was something that could probably never be done again and certainly won't consistently be done.
Holy shit, man. There's so many inputs on this that when you think you have a grasp on it, all of a sudden you get flipped on your head with it. So
hockey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say football too, right? I mean, some of the things you say sound similar to like Elway's model of how he likes to work and where he doesn't pay a shit ton of money for a quarterback.
Well, and he won't pay a lot of money for inside linebackers, and he keeps mining practice squads for them, and he keeps doing it because teams hadn't figured out that they could just use whatever shitty tight ends they had to abuse those linebackers. And when Atlanta rolled into Denver last year and they basically gave the blueprint on how to beat this defense when they used their running backs and their tight ends to match up on the outside against Denver's shitty inside linebackers. They've been saving money there for years and actively avoiding addressing the position because they could spend more elsewhere at skill positions. You know, they could go four or five cornerbacks deep because they were saving money on inside linebackers, and then they got exposed and they haven't adjusted. And that's one of their biggest problems on defense now, is that they haven't adjusted to that. And that crazy pass rush, you know, it's Vaughn is amazing, but Vaughn is nowhere near enough to get that job done, you know, and Shane Ray hasn't developed and Shaq Barrett can't stop the run and so on and so forth. So, you know, you have to take your chances in building a roster and where you're going to save money and where you're going to try and cut corners. You know, Elway has done it at some spots, you know, quarterback being one of them and inside linebackers certainly being another one. And then, you know, the Avs have been doing it organizationally. They've been doing it at goaltender.
So do you think that's their model then? They believe they can build the team in a way where the goaltender is not nearly as pivotal as they used to kind of put on the goaltender?
I would say the next, what is it, December? I would say the next 18 months is going to tell us exactly how important that is to them, because it's kind of been a luxury for them that they've had Varley signed and they had previous success with him. So they could just say, he's our guy, and then we're just going to run him out until the end of his contract. But depending on how he plays or doesn't play, and you know, if he ever gets back into that 920 range, which I think he's capable of. And really this year, if you take away, he's got three bad starts and seven in out of 20 appearances that are really holding him back. He's got three bad appearances that if you take off his record, I believe he's a 920 goaltender. So Varley's actually been sneaky good, and the numbers are just a little deceptively bad because he did give up 7 goals in Vegas. He did give up 5 goals in Nashville. He did give up 3 goals on 8 shots in that Dallas fiasco a few weeks ago when he came in for Bernier. You know, like those types of those small bad performances have been enough to statistically sink him to the level he's in right now.
And so when you talk about stats and the deficiencies in stats, is it just stats over time or the amount of stats being looked at and collected by, I don't know, wherever stats go, the NHL or wherever does it?
Definitely both. I mean, stats over time is a huge, when you hear guys, we talk about sample sizes all the time. And, you know, more information is always better. The more numbers that you have, you know, the more appearances a guy has, the more you're getting an idea of his true talent level and who he really is. That's why I'm looking at Varley. I'm looking at Varley's career right now, and it's just an average career. It just is. It's just average with a really, really good high point and a really bad low point last year with that 898.
And do you think the defense affects his game the way that, say, another top center would affect, you know, a guy who's just being picked on by the other team in every game plan they put together for him? Like, is there a way for a goaltender to get help from the people around him to be better? I mean, it seems obvious, but is there really a defenseman who's going to come in and make a substantial change in his numbers?
No, not in his numbers. Defense isn't an individual thing. Defense is a concept. Defense is a team-wide responsibility. And it's one of the things where Avalanche fans have been wildly misguided for many years now, is the obsession with defensemen, as if that's all they do is play defense, and as if the forwards have no role in it. I don't think it's an accident whatsoever that Matt Duchene disappeared and this team's defensive numbers took a jump, because defensively he was not good. He was not good. And he's in Ottawa now, and we've seen their numbers have gone down to where Colorado's numbers used to be. They've cratered since he got there, because that's the push and pull that you have with Matt Duchene as a player, especially as a center, where he's playing such a pivotal role in the center of the ice. He's kind of your guy that has to be the most defensively aware. The Avs have guys like Tyson Jost and JT Compher and Carl Soderberg who are smart and aware defensive players, even if they're not always the best. They're guys, you know, Blake Como, you know, on the wall, he's a really smart defensive center. And I say that after last night, in which he got absolutely worked multiple times in the defensive zone. But he's a smart player. They make good reads. They understand rotations. They understand the team system. And that's what makes them good and effective in their own zone. Whereas a guy like Duchene, it just never clicked for him. You know, MacKinnon is kind of the same way, but to a little bit of a lesser extent. He's not as much of a liability defensively as Duchene is, where, you know, Mac, he doesn't read the game very well on defense, but he understands when he has opportunities to transition it to offense. And just that little bit of understanding, that little bit of hockey IQ, is enormous for him being able to transition. And that all goes to team. And that looks like good defense when you're watching it. Is, oh, he's got this opportunity, he bangs it off the wall, he steps around a guy, he picks up the puck, and he goes and does something fucking amazing, and we all freak out about it. And, you know, we don't ever look at that and say, wow, what a great defensive play. We just say Nathan MacKinnon's a monster and we move on. But defense, I mean, defense is a concept. You know, that one of the most interesting things was a couple years ago when they brought in Dave Farish from Toronto, when Patrick Waugh hired Dave Farish, and they brought in this old, super old school defensive style, blocked tons of shots. You know, Francois Beauchemin and Eric Johnson led the NHL in shots blocked. The Avs had, like, I think three or four guys in the top 12 of shots blocked a couple years ago. And that was a defensive system. And that made life so miserable. The goaltenders hated it, because block shots lead to awkward tips and random deflections and, you know, all kinds of unforeseen nonsense. Goaltenders would rather you just get the hell out of the way and rely on themselves. So, you know, defensive systems and defensive players can 100% have an effect on how hard it is to be a goaltender on a specific team. And last year, we saw how awful that defense was. In our eyes, we were like, God, this defense is bad. But there were a lot of underlying numbers that said this, things are getting better. They just don't have the right guys in place for it. And we're seeing that manifest itself a lot more this year as the team-wide defense improves. You know, the Avs, like I said, their high danger chances and all that really, really has improved by a lot. You know, the last couple of years, it's just raw. It's not Corsi, but it's actual just shots on goal against. They've been giving up 32 to 35 the last couple of years. They are after a couple of games now, you know, they had a couple of rough games where they gave up 40. So those numbers have dropped quite a bit. They're back down to 32.06 right now. And they're 20th in the NHL or 21st in the NHL.
Yeah, I mean, all the signs point to better things. And this is where I start to wonder about stats, though, is like, I feel like the Avs brought on some people to look at numbers and then we heard absolutely nothing. And I wonder how they're intending to use them. But it got me to thinking, too, that are analytics really a way to kind of verify what you think is a person who's looking at intangibles, or is everything that isn't a stat an intangible? And that's what you do after you look at stats.
They work together. You know, anybody that has a brain will tell you that they work together. You know, you need... You need to have You want to know the something on ice that we've seen that is a change because of their analytics. Look at how they run their power play and the drop pass that they use on the power play. That's a direct result of analytics.
Is it really?
Yeah, because the number one thing that you need to do that leads to goals scored, and this is not just at power plays, is it all strengths, is controlled zone entries. When you enter the offensive zone with control of the puck, you're not dumping and chasing, you're not passing it around, you have the puck. Your team has the puck. Your percentage of scoring goes up significantly. We're talking like 30-40% higher chance of scoring than you do for a random dump in. And so when you look at the power play, you say, okay, we need to come up with a way to give us as many controlled zone entries as possible, because those lead to us setting up the power play, which leads to us scoring more power play goals, which leads to us converting on more of our chances.
And this replaces the dump and chase, right?
Right. And that's the whole, and the numbers bear this out. And so that's why you're seeing, it's not just the Avs. There's a lot of teams that are doing it where they're running variations of that drop pass. And then you have to, because teams adjust to it. You know, we saw, who do they just beat? Three, four nights ago, Florida was here. And we saw Florida trying to run a similar type drop pass. And the Avs PKers, they had Landeskog staying behind he was forechecking, and as they would move the puck through the neutral zone on the power play, Landeskog was hanging behind that guy so that he could try and prevent the drop pass immediately. And he did it multiple times. He disrupted it a couple of different times. And so teams have to make these little micro adjustments where, okay, if they're going to try that drop pass, now they've got to do this. They've got to put bodies here. They've got to put bodies there. And it just becomes this ongoing chess match that never really ends. You're always making the adjustments, but that's why that exists on the power play, is because that's a direct result of analytics telling them this improves your chance of scoring by, 40-fold. You have X number of percentages on scoring on dump-ins on the power play, in which you're trying to win 50-50 puck battles and then set up from there, versus controlled zone entries where all your guys walk into the zone. You make two or three quick little passes. You get the defense adjusts. You play around what they're doing. And the next thing you know, you've set up shop and you're ready to go to work. So that's a direct result of analytics is their power play. And that's what, when they hired Eric, that was his specialty, was his expertise was all about power plays and special teams in particular, and how to maximize the efficiency and how best to, where the numbers were coming from. He had developed his own metrics. He had done extensive, far more extensive work than anyone else on special teams work. And when he got to Denver, he just took all the work he'd done and immediately began implementing it. And they brought in a coaching staff that's willing to listen to those conversations. It's not an old school coaching staff that's like, you're a fucking nerd. These numbers are irrelevant. Games aren't played on a computer, blah, blah, blah. All the old adages that you hear all the time about how analytics are irrelevant or dumb or whatever.
Don't tell me how to play the game. Right. I've been doing it for years.
Exactly. Kind of thing. The coaching staff is willing to listen. They work with the video department in implementing it, and they talk to specific players about how to go about putting these processes and procedures kind of into place. And how to, how to do work, man. Like that's what they work on. That's what the video department does. That's what the analytics department does. They find all this data. They pull it all up. They generate all of it. They show how what they're doing is working with certain personnel and without certain personnel, and who's succeeding in what situations and who's not. And then the coaches, they get the video coach to cut video of those situations. And then they watch the video with either as a team or as a unit or as, and if the case needs to be, then with specific players on certain types of situations and how to improve in those areas.
So is there then metrics for players that are prospects where they look at it and say, look, this guy is adaptable. He can change what he's doing based on what we're seeing and then what we tell him to do, instead of a guy who's just kind of set in his way. Like Soderberg is pretty predictable, man. I love what he does when he's doing it the way he is kind of right now, which is, you know, not always appreciated by everyone, but he's not really going to dangle much. He's going to shoot the fucking puck from anywhere. Anytime that he can, he kind of just goes north-south in what I see in his game. So he doesn't seem like a guy who's going to really be pliable when it comes to, hey, we have some new ideas based on this and that. We want you to go implement those in a real game. I mean, is that a metric you can point to, or is that one of the intangibles?
As far as I know, that's not something that we're going to be able to ever be able to really quantify. Oh, hey, Spencer Martin won today. Speaking of goaltenders.
Nice. I do like Martin, by the way. I just don't think he's the answer.
I agree. I'm ultra athletic, but technically I don't think it's there.
I just like his willingness to play the puck. It's always entertaining.
It's nice to have a goaltender that will play a puck, because they've got Varley, and I think it's something that's caused, I think it's caused problems for years.
I think he's better off not playing it too. I mean, I think they tried it with him, and he looks like my dog when he doesn't want to go outside. He just kind of sits back and doesn't look at you in the eye kind of thing. Like, I'm not touching that puck.
Yeah, he's, God, man, I tell you what, and the way that he'll just cover a puck, when you have a bad defensive team, even a mediocre defensive team, you can't willingly take that many face-offs in your own zone. That's it just compounds all their other problems that they've had for years, is a guy that won't play the puck. Like, if the Avs could get a guy like Mike Smith, who's phenomenal at playing the puck and who's ultra aggressive and he's like a third defenseman back there, it would make so much of a difference. It's one of the sneaky things that people don't ever talk about Nashville's defense, is that Pecorine is a phenomenal puck handler. And they're able to do whatever they want because he can go back there and just do it.
Well, there's not many fluffs. I mean, every now and then, but not nearly as many successes. I mean, there's a lot of breaks that I'm seeing coming from goaltenders anymore. Bishop used to be really good at it, too. But Varley's not that guy.
Varley's awful at it, man. He's got to be among the worst. And he knows it, too. Like, that's the crazy thing. He knows it, man. So he doesn't try it. And I just don't understand how you can be in the NHL and be actively that bad at part of your job and not work on it.
Is it part of his job, you think, though? Is that expected in goaltenders now? Is you got to be able to play that puck?
You have to be able to do some. I mean, they give you a fucking stick. Otherwise, why bother, right? Like, they give you a stick, you have to do something with it, man. It's got to do more than just cover the five hole when you go down, you know? Like, yeah, you need to be able to play the puck. And it's the one thing, the one like really bad long-term downside of the trapezoid, is that goaltenders grow up not having to play the puck anymore. It's not a big deal. And so future generations of goaltenders are not going to be able to play the puck because they haven't spent their life doing it.
Yeah, that was the Wild West back then. I loved that kind of hockey, but you have to admit it was getting a little bit crazy. I mean, if Brodeur was back there, you weren't really going to get anything going with the dump and chase for sure.
Right. Like, he would go to the corner and grab the puck and move it. And that was that. And congrats, you got nothing.
As natural as a defenseman would, in my opinion. I mean, the guy was fucking good. He could put the puck right where he wanted it. If he wanted it 3 feet off the glass or something like that, he could do it.
Yeah, he was amazing at it. And I have absolutely no issues with like that rule. But it is one of the unintended consequences, is that goaltenders don't play pucks anymore. And when they do, they're not very good at it.
Are goalies, when do you start drafting goalies? I mean, it doesn't seem like a first round thing unless you just have a real, real good reason to look at a guy like that, because there's so much talent in the forward and even defense at this point. So when do you start looking at goalies?
Late first round if there's a guy that you think is a special prospect. This last year, I thought Jake Oettinger was a special prospect. He's a guy that I would have been totally okay with Colorado taking that 32nd pick and moving up to go get. You know, as it is now, I'm totally happy with Connor Timmins. But, you know, it teams that have multiple first round picks, you can really look at that, especially if the second first round pick, you know, if you have one in like the top five or whatever, and then you have another one in the 20s, you have that conversation. You say, hey, do we really want to look at this guy in this spot? This is a premium pick. You know, it's a bit of a luxury that they have it in the first place. Do they really want to go that route? And more often than not, you're going to say no. It's too rich for team's blood. But with Colorado, they haven't shown that willingness to invest in a goaltender. You know, that the last time Spencer Martin was the last time they used a high draft pick on a goaltender. He was a third round pick back in 2013.
That was a totally different regime as far as scouting goes, too, right?
It was. And it was. And that was a Patrick Waugh thing where I think Patty, I've always connected those two. I think Patty really liked him. And, you know, before that, the last time they've used a second round pick on a goaltender was Calvin Pickard. You know, they used a 49th overall pick and got him. And they're going to have, with Ottawa completely falling apart, they may not get that first round pick until 2019, but they're guaranteed to have an extra second round pick this year from Nashville. They need to use one of those second round picks on one of the top goaltending prospects. They need to. The rest of their organization is shored up enough. They've got decent forward prospects. They're probably going to use their first round pick. If they only have one, they're probably going to use it on a forward. So that would fill their most immediate need in terms of what they absolutely have to have is another high end forward. Wing center, I'm not going to worry too much about right now, because if I were to ask you right now who's Colorado's second line center, we don't have an answer to that question. So
that's true.
I'm not worried about wing center or any of that. Ideally, I mean, you get an ultra goal scoring wing in Andrei Svechnikov, but that's a conversation for a draft pod.
And it seems like a lot of centers are interchangeable now with being wingers too. And often it's based on how well they play defense. So I don't know if that's a real thing or not, but it seems like it's something you could look at least.
Well, and you know, teams, you always put your best forwards on at center to start with, and then, you know, you go from there. But they, you know, right now, Colorado really needs a high end forward more than anything else. So that's what they should do and likely will do in the first round with their first pick. If they end up with two first rounders, they'll probably go forward and D, you know, whatever combination. With the outside chance of them going forward.
Gotcha. Do you think it's a small guy, or is it going to be, does it matter? Can it be a power forward, or does that be a sniper?
No idea, but it needs to be a guy that can shoot. That needs to be a priority for them. It needs to be a guy that part of his repertoire is his shot. A guy like Oliver Wahlstrom is a perfect example of where they should start looking. So
I'd love to find a line, eh? That'd be okay.
Well, yeah. And when I bring up Svechnikov, I always refer to Svechnikov as Ovechkin light. So go there. You know, if they could get Svechnikov, it would be, for one, Mikko Rantanen becomes your second line right wing. He's that good, you know, and that would solve a lot of their goal scoring issues. Would be, whoo, baby. Like, that changes the whole team if that happens. But anyway, You need to get a high end forward in the first round, no matter what. And then you'll probably get a D if they get that second pick from Ottawa this year. But in the second round, they need to go goaltender. And I would prefer for them to use Colorado's their own pick, because it's going to be much higher than Nashville's pick on the goaltender. But we don't know what this goalie class looks like yet. That might just be a little bit rich. That might be just a little bit too high, because it's not shaping up to be a really strong goaltender class, just more of an okay one. And so you don't maybe want to use the 35th or the 37th pick or whatever the Avs end up using their, you know, wherever their position ends up being. You know, maybe you don't want to use that pick on that guy when you've got borderline first round talents that are still in that top second round range. You know, maybe use the Nashville pick, which earlier I said was like 57th in that range. I think that's probably appropriate. That 57th pick, you want to use that. You want to start having that conversation about a goaltender in that area. That's a premium pick. It's a high level pick. I don't have a strong preference on European versus CHL versus college kid. I know the Avs do, but I don't personally have like a strong, just pick a good one. Pick one of the good ones that's not an overager, that, you know, that does not fit the recent trend of them trying to pull a rabbit out of the hat with some of these goaltenders. Because then them going with the overage route and the, oh, he's got his own net. And philosophically, I totally get it. But you need to pick a guy that's got major talent at some point. You need to stop trying to mine. You know, with Alan Heppel, that seems to be his biggest weakness for me as at the drafting table, is the overage goaltending strategy. You know, with Rick Pracy, he was trying to use those middle picks to find Johnny Gaudreau all the time. He was constantly drafting these 5'9", 5'10" little guys that could do things here and there, but weren't nearly skilled enough to get away with that. You know, they weren't quite that good. So they've got to figure it out. You know, they've got to find a middle ground. They really need to target some of the high end talent. The kid out of Halifax this year, Gravel. That's fine. Like, start there. You know, there's a number of interesting options for them, but that second round pick with Nash, that's the Nashville second round pick. If they don't use that on a goaltender, I'm going to scream.
All right. Two more questions to wrap it up then. One, does size still matter? Is that an asset in a goalie or no?
It is. It's absolutely an asset. You know, we're seeing UC Saros in Nashville is only 5'11" and he's one of the top goaltending prospects on the planet. But he is the exception. You know, Michael DiPietro had a phenomenal run to the Memorial Cup last year, and we saw him drop further in the draft than was expected. And it's because he's only 6 feet tall. Size is a big, big, big thing. And we've seen with the Avalanche, you know, one of the big things they really liked about Adam Warner is that he's 6'5". And, you know, you go up and down the list of top goaltenders in the NHL. Those guys are all big. The small man revolution that is going on in the NHL does not apply to netminders. It just doesn't. It still pays to be big, and you're still going to have just that inherent advantage by being a big dude when your job is to get in front of stuff.
I mean, if you can play position, then you're always going to have that extra inch on the guy that doesn't, right? And it could be your shoulder width or something. So it seems realistic, too, if a goalie was going to get older, that if he's bigger, he's still going to be better than a guy who's smaller, losing some speed and agility. Right. How deep can you go in the draft? I mean, where do you find the drop off of NHL caliber goaltenders as far as, like, is it third round? Anything past that, you're really hoping for a miracle?
Anything, man. When you're drafting goaltenders, you're hoping for a miracle no matter what. Honestly, I'm not kidding. Like, if you run down the list of all the starters in the NHL today, you will have everything from first round picks to guys that were picked in rounds that don't exist anymore. I'm sure that there's a couple of guys out there who were undrafted even. Like, the Abs have two first round picks on their roster. Bernier and Varley were both first rounders.
No.
But
Bernier?
Yeah, Bernier was a first rounder by the Kings. He was a high first rounder too.
Huh. Okay.
Like a high first rounder. I want to say he was drafted like, I'm just going to look it up, 11th overall.
That's high, right? Really high.
That's really high. Like, today, and that happened back then. But in today's drafting world, you're not going to see a goaltender go much higher than what Ottinger did last year when I think they took him 26th.
And does he seem real to you?
I loved Ottinger. I thought Ottinger was the truth and the real deal. And he's gone out and he's had a horrible sophomore year at Boston University, which just goes to show you that, one, I don't know shit about goaltending, and two, neither does anybody else. But did you know John Bernier has 4 assists in his career?
No, I don't even see that.
I had no idea. So, wow, I didn't know that. Varley and Bernier were drafted in the same first round.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, Bernier 11th overall and Varley 23rd overall. I knew they were first rounder. I didn't know they were in the same year.
I didn't either. As you start looking back at the draft, and I've been doing it more and more lately, it's amazing how long guys have been in the league when they're not that old. And these guys aren't a great example of that. But, like, Mac has been in the league for a long time. He's, what, 22 or something?
Yeah, it's his fifth year. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and Kerfoot's older than he is.
Which is also entertaining.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy when you get those, like, the kids that come in and they're actually fucking kids. Like, I call JT Compher a kid, but, like, you know, that's just because he's in his early 20s. But he's not like a baby anymore. You know, like, Mac was a baby when he got here.
And he's been developing right in front of us, too. And I don't know, he's reached a ceiling I wasn't sure he was going to get to. I mean, he's always been great, right? But you just never know. You never know if a guy's going to put it all together. And I think he's starting to do it. We'll see if it's consistent or not. But man, he's electrifying right now.
This is the first in a series of podcasts that we're doing about what we're calling the goaltending situation. A huge thanks to AJ Hafley for taking the time to talk to us and give us so much knowledge about the Colorado Avalanche. If you'd like to follow AJ, you can follow him on Twitter at AJ Hafley or at bsnavalanche.com. If you, like me, are a fan of the BSN Avalanche podcast and all of the reporting that they do, you should probably think about going over there and subscribing to what they're doing. They're going to flip the way that news is reported on its head and give you exactly what you want without any ads, which I think is pretty cool. It's pretty cheap, a couple bucks. Check it out. This and every other podcast that we do is brought to you by AbsFam, absfam.com. Awesome hockey shirts for awesome hockey people. Go there and check out the 20 plus designs that we've done so far and see if you can't find something that you'd love. If this podcast is your kind of thing and it puts sprinkles on your donuts, stay tuned because we have another one on the same topic with Kat Silverman coming up here soon. She's got a little bit of a different take on goaltenders and the analytics around them, and it's absolutely fascinating. Stay awesome.